Explicit content is found in this episode, so listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. I don't often like to cover cold cases or disappearances. I like to have resolution. I like to know the end. When the end is unclear or met with conspiracy theories, it makes researching the case a little more difficult. It's almost as if the universe has said, "This is it. This is all you get." However, I stumbled upon the disappearance of Joan Risch. I wanted to know more about this case. What were the circumstances of her disappearance, and what was the quality of the investigation? And at the end of my research, I felt like everyone else. I just wanted to know, where is Joan? Okay, on to the show. Joan was born in Brooklyn, New York in August of 1931. An only child, she would experience loss early in life. In 1940, her parents perished in a house fire. The cause of the fire was unknown, but many speculate that it was arson. The case remains unsolved. She would later be adopted by her maternal aunt and uncle. Joan would share with close friends that she was being sexually abused constantly by her uncle. During this time, sexual abuse was not often discussed, nor was it reported, so Joan suffered in silence. She did, however, have reading and writing, which offered her an escape from the abuse. She took her passion for reading and writing to Wilson College in Pennsylvania, where she would graduate in 1952 with a degree in English literature. Her ambition was to work in publishing, so she aimed her sights on New York City. Upon arriving there, she took a job as a secretary at Thomas Crowe Publishing House. She quickly advanced through the ranks and became an editorial assistant. It was at Thomas Crowe where she would meet her future husband, Martin Risch. Martin was a busy executive who wanted to start a family immediately with Joan. As a result, she left the publishing company and had their first child, Lillian, in 1957. In 1959, they welcomed a son, David. Martin, wanting to advance in his career, accepted a position in Lincoln, Massachusetts as the head executive of the Fitchburg Paper Company. Joan shared with Martin that once the children were both in school, she would like to become a teacher. He told her that he supported this dream. They moved to Lincoln, Massachusetts in April of 1961. Joan kept herself busy with the children, she visited the local library, and she was an active member in the League of Women Voters. By all accounts, she was a busy woman. She was noted to be a loving and devoted mother, a faithful wife, and involved in her community. She was a good citizen. Having only been in Lincoln just 6 short months, this was quite an accomplishment. October 24th, 1961 began like most days in the Risch household. Martin, who often traveled for work, was on his way to the airport bound for New York. He left home just before 7 a.m. Joan would wake the children, fix them breakfast, and make any last-minute adjustments to her grocery list. Once the children finished their food, she would dress them, drop her son David off with neighbor Barbara Barker, while her and Lillian went to the dentist. Joan arrives to the dentist office and has her cavity filled. She knows that she needs more work done on her mouth, so she makes a follow-up appointment for the 31st. Her and Lillian depart the dentist office and go to the local shopping mall, where she purchases a small gift for David and a bra for herself. They then go grocery shopping. She arrives back to her home around 11 a.m. and unloads. She notices that her milk and mail have arrived, though she just missed both carriers. She walks to Barbara's house and picks up David. He is ready for his afternoon nap. When she arrives back home, she runs into Walton Colburn, a driver for the pickup and delivery dry cleaner that the Risches use. A note for the listener: this was 1961 in a fairly affluent neighborhood, it was the norm to leave your door unlocked, and it was often not out of the ordinary to have your milkman or dry cleaner enter your home to pick up or drop off. Walton and Joan chatted for a bit. He picked up Mr. Rich's dry cleaning and then left. Joan cooks lunch for her and the children. She settles David in for his nap and begins working on her plants and flowers in the front yard as Lillian plays with Barbara's son, Douglas. The routine that she maintains is right on schedule until 1:55 p.m. It is at that time that she walks Douglas and Lillian back to Barbara's house and leaves them at the swing set. She tells Lillian that she will return, but fails to inform Barbara that the children are in her backyard playing. 20 minutes later, at 2:15 p.m., Barbara, whose view is slightly obstructed by some evergreen trees, believes she saw Joan wearing a trench coat over her blue house dress, carrying something red with outstretched arms from her car towards the garage. She noticed that Joan looked a little frazzled, but assumed that this was from chasing baby David. This would be the last sighting of Joan Risch. Lillian and Douglas continue to play outside for the next hour. Around 3:15, Virginia Keene, a child of the Risch's next-door neighbors, got off of her school bus and walked towards her home. As she was walking, she noticed an unfamiliar car. Speculating that it was a GM model car, she noticed that it was dirty and had two-tone paint. But most importantly, it was parked in front of the Risch home. Another resident of that neighborhood recalled stopping to let a car of that make back out of either the Keene or Risch driveway. Virginia and her mother would later recall that there was no such car in their driveway that day. It was 3:40 p.m., and Barbara needed to run some errands, so she told Lillian that she would walk her home. She walked her just up until the driveway and turned back towards her home. She left and returned home around 4:15 p.m. She noticed that Lillian was on her porch, and she looked frightened. She approached her and asked her what was wrong. Lillian stated, "Mommy is gone, and the kitchen is covered with red paint. And David is crying because his diaper needs to be changed." Concerned, Barbara went back to the house with Lillian and came upon a grisly scene. She called for Joan, but there was no answer. She heard David crying and quickly noticed the trash can in the middle of the kitchen floor. It had the phone receiver. It had been ripped from the wall and placed carefully in the trash bin. What's worse was the amount of blood that was found on the kitchen floor and streaked on the walls that sent chills down Barbara's spine. She ran upstairs where David was, taking note of the trail of blood that led to his crib. She picked up the crying child and quickly ran back to her house with the children. She phoned the police, as this was before the days of 911, and informed them of the bloody scene at the Risch home. Around 5 p.m., the police arrived, with Sergeant Mike McHugh acting as the lead detective. He walked in and noted that the kitchen was in such a disarray. A chair had been knocked over. The trash can was curiously in the middle of the room. Blood smears were on the floor, and it seemed as if someone had attempted to clean it up with rags and David's overalls. He came across the phone book, which was underneath the chair, open to the emergency numbers page. A thought flashed across his mind. Perhaps she had injured herself and was attempting to seek medical assistance. He noted that other areas of the house were not out of place. There seemed to have been nothing stolen, so the idea of a robbery gone bad didn't really fit this crime scene. He continued his search of the house and followed the trail of blood upstairs. Nothing besides the blood seemed out of place. The thought that she may have committed suicide crossed his mind, but without being able to locate her body in the home, he thought a search around the outside of the house was necessary. He exited the home to continue his search outside. He wrote down that the trail of blood continued to Jones' parked car in the driveway. There was blood on the hood, fender, and center of the trunk. He called dispatch and requested that more officers come to investigate the house and retrieve any additional evidence. Martin, upon landing in New York, received the news that his wife had gone missing, so he boarded the next plane for Boston and headed home. Police continued their investigation of what evidence was left in the house. They noted that the mail had not been brought in and that Jones' purse and wallet remained in the house, along with the trench coat that Barbara saw her wearing earlier that day. They canvassed the neighborhood to see if anyone had noticed anything out of the ordinary with Joan that day. Several sightings were reported that day by residents in Massachusetts, either in Lincoln or Waltham, Massachusetts, which is about an hour away. At 2:45 p.m., a woman said she saw a woman wearing clothing similar to what Joan was wearing, a blue house dress, white sneakers, and a coat, walking along aimlessly on Route 2A. She was hunched over and clutching her abdomen. Around 3:15 and 3:30 p.m., another sighting was reported on Route 128. It's a medium strip that's located in Waltham, Massachusetts. She again was clutching her abdomen, but blood was seen running down both the front and back of her legs. No one stopped to question or to help. Around 4:30 p.m., another sighting similar to the ones before said that they saw her walking down Route 128 and she veered off to the side somewhere. No other sightings past 4:30 p.m. were reported. Martin arrived home to be questioned by police. They asked about the bottle of liquor and Miller Lite beer bottles that were found in his home. He stated that the bottle had been emptied by him and Joan the night before, but that the beer bottles were new, and he could not account from where they came from. He further stated that if an intruder had indeed attacked Joan, that she would have fought tooth and nail to ensure David, who was possibly still asleep upstairs, would have been spared. Martin confirmed that nothing of value was missing from the home. After the sightings had been reported, a ground and air search of the surrounding woodland, reservoirs, and buildings found no trace of Joan. They resumed their work on the home and discovered a partial palm print and thumbprint on the wall. They compared these prints to Joan's medical records and discovered that they did not belong to anyone residing in the Risch home. However, the blood was believed to have been Joan's, as she was type O. Similarly, and oddly, detectives noticed that there were no bloody shoe or footprints in the home. This meant that whoever was walking around the house did so carefully, or was just really lucky. Where the blood trail began was unable to be determined, but most investigators agreed that the trail possibly ended at the driveway. Joan could have been forced into a car and driven away. The mailman, dry cleaner, and milkman were each ruled out as suspects when they were questioned about their visit to the home that day. They each stated that nothing seemed out of place or odd about the home or Joan. The chemist who was in charge of collecting the blood evidence at the scene stated that while it looked like a mortal wound may have been caused due to the amount of blood, it was actually only half a pint, which meant that whatever injury Joan may have sustained was not life-threatening. And although it may have looked like a struggle took place, that it could very well have been that Joan was injured and was trying to support herself but stumbled around. Martin was cleared of any suspicion since he was in New York at the time. The trail for Joan essentially went cold. It wasn't until 2 years later when the circumstances of Joan's disappearance would be called into question. Namely, was it voluntary or involuntary? A local newspaper reporter by the name of Serene Gerson seemed to have found the next clue in this odd case. She was at the local library when she found a book covering the mysterious disappearance of Brigham Young's 27th wife. She reviewed the checkout card and found a familiar name, Joan Risch. She had checked out this book on September 16, 1961. She wondered if there were other books Joan had checked out. She recalled Martin and friends saying what an avid reader she was. She continued perusing the aisle and found two more books, with the checkout card having Joan's signature. She knew if she found more than one book, that Joan had likely checked out others. She assembled a group of volunteers who combed the stacks of books. They found 25 more books that she had checked out the summer of her disappearance. Most of the books were on murders or unexplained disappearances. Gerson later told the Boston Globe, "The whole thing added up to our feeling that she had planned the disappearance and was looking for a way to do it. She felt that Joan's happiness was a facade covering up the ambition and drive she had to have a career of her own, stunted in large part by her marriage and children." Martin and several of Joan's close friends would dispute this opinion by saying that Joan was happy in her marriage and that she would have never left the children she loved more than anything in the world. However, once news of what Joan had checked out at the library made the local paper, the news and gossip quickly circulated. Joan's past was making an appearance. The death of her parents in that mysterious house fire and the alleged sexual abuse at the hands of her uncle made people wonder, was Joan tired of being Joan? Did she read up on how to make herself disappear? Martin always defended her reading by saying she loved a good suspense. In November of 1961, Martin's house phone rang about a dozen times. His father answered the phone each time and stated that the caller refused to speak with him. That same day, a neighbor reported that a terribly excited woman called her and complained that she had been trying to call her home, but that she hadn't been able to get a hold of anyone she knew. Was it Joan that called? I find it hard to believe. If it was, how could she have not recognized her father-in-law's voice? It was likely that the two had met before, and judging by him being at the house days later, he must have been close to the family. It's unclear if police were notified of the calls. As time passed, Martin held on to the belief that his wife was alive somewhere, suffering from amnesia. He would believe this up until his death in 2009. As no trace of Joan has been found, it is unclear what fate she ultimately met. Several theories surfaced of what could have happened. The first one, she was attacked by an unknown assailant in her home, injured in some way, and forced into a waiting vehicle. Second, she was assaulted by an unknown assailant in her home, incurred an injury to her head during the altercation, which caused some brain trauma, possibly amnesia, or severe disorientation, but she was able to get away, which is where the sightings along the various routes come into play. However, the attacker may have followed her or stumbled upon her again as they drove away from the home. They pulled over and completed the attack, possibly discarding her body along Route 128 or disposing of her somewhere else. 3. She suffered some sort of medical emergency that involved hemorrhaging and, due to the blood loss, was disoriented and seeking help. This could explain the woman seen clutching her abdomen, walking along routes 2A and 128, bleeding down both sides of her leg. 4. She could have suffered a mental break and just walked away, but that doesn't explain the bloody handprints in the home that don't belong to anyone else. 5. The New England Untold Stories Group believe Joan was murdered by an associate of William Barker, the husband of neighbor Barbara Barker. They owned an empty lot, which a month after Joan's disappearance, they began to build on. It has never been excavated, but again, this is highly unlikely since no motive has ever been produced. 6. And more chilling, could be a rumor circulating that Joan was pregnant and didn't want a third child. She arranged for a doctor to perform an abortion in her own home. Although abortion was illegal, they were still carried out in private at that time. Joan could have been injured during the abortion, so she stumbles to the kitchen where she pulls out the phone book for the emergency numbers. Remember, this is before 911. The physician, concerned for his reputation, medical license, and potential legal consequences, prevents her from calling the police and rips the phone out of the wall. He forces her out of the house and into the car. On the way out, he leaves bloody handprints on the wall and some that are later found on the car. There is also the case of the wire hanger found on top of Joan's car. He places her in his car and then abandons her on Route 2A, where she is possibly seen walking along the road, clutching her abdomen and bleeding down her legs. Of course, the theory that she cut herself and staged the entire disappearance is also floating out there. The car in the driveway is concerning to me, but it remains unsolved. Some reports from the police state that the car was actually just an unmarked police vehicle. Others believe it was her assailant. Despite interviewing a man who had a similar car, he was ruled out. There are a lot of questions surrounding her disappearance, and much of what is out there is simply speculation. I would like to lean towards a more positive route, if you will, as positive as this can possibly be, and I believe Joan staged it. She could have been unhappy with her life, and knowing all the steps women had to take to get a divorce at that time, it was likely that just walking away would be easier. Joan could have been somebody else. Joan dropping Lillian and Gregory off without telling Barbara is what makes me believe this was planned. I can't explain the woman seen wandering, but perhaps it was a show, or maybe she actually was injured in some way, or maybe it wasn't even Joan. What baffles me more about that situation is that multiple people drove past this woman and offered no assistance. Whatever really happened, we will never know. Not until Joan is found, alive or dead. I'm curious. What are your thoughts? Be sure to share those with me on social media. Until next time. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and review on iTunes. It really helps us out. You can find us on most social media platforms. Twitter at TCFCPod, Facebook.com/TCFCPodcast, and of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request, send us an email, TCFCPod@gmail.com. We are so excited for 2017. We're going to be adding merchandise, and we're attending CrimeCon this year. So if you're coming, be sure to let me know, and I'll look out for you. While you're waiting for the next episode, here are some other great true crime podcasts you can listen to. Actual Innocence, a podcast sharing the stories of the wrongfully convicted. Twisted Philly, it's a podcast dedicated to host Dina's favorite things about Philadelphia and Philadelphia at large, from the mundane to the macabre. You will hear stories about true crime, haunted history, cool and creepy places to visit, Philly legends, and much more. True Crime All the Time. It's a new podcast about all things true crime, and it's hosted by Mike Ferguson. If you're looking for a podcast that is not true crime, but love ghost stories, follow my newfound and now favorite podcast called Ghost in the Burbs. It's a podcast about the ghosties living in Wellesley, Massachusetts, and the suburbanites who encounter them. So that's it. I hope you enjoy the recommendations and happy listening.